The Religious Freedom Restoration Act, RFRA, or more properly, RFRAs plural, because there are lots of them out there, has been a subject we've talked about before on the show. And we've also talked about a somewhat strangely related subject, gay marriage. Recently, I made a presentation at the University of Tennessee's Law School where one of my colleagues and I got into a very animated discussion, and it led to a conversation that I'm going to share with you today. That's with David Wolitz. Right after that, I'll speak with my old buddy Doug McKechnie, and between the two of them, we're going to have ourselves a RFRA redux. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. It's all about gay marriage, RFRAs, David and Doug and I.
Welcome to your Weekly Constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris and produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
One of the nicest things about teaching every summer at the University of Tennessee's College of Law is that they typically invite me to give a lunchtime presentation to my colleagues, and I get the benefit of listening to presentations by all those colleagues as well. And the really nice thing about the faculty there is that they're composed of genuinely smart and genuinely nice people who are genuinely interested in each other's work. And so it was no surprise recently when I did a presentation on Religious Freedom Restoration Acts, or RFRAs, that it led to a very spirited, a very animated discussion, particularly with one particular colleague of mine. His name is David Wolitz, and David also teaches constitutional law, and he's actually in the middle of, I think, writing an article on Religious Freedom Restoration Acts. And I said a couple of things in my presentation that he took issue with, and we had a really interesting discussion. At least we found it interesting. I don't know if everybody else was getting bored, but at the end of it, I said, David, this was great. Let's continue this in your office, and I'm going to turn on my microphone.
My name is David Wolitz, and I'm an associate professor of law here at the University of Tennessee College of Law, and among other things, I teach constitutional law.
What a concept. I knew that because you're good looking.
And thank you.
Con law professors are the best looking.
That's what they tell me.
Exactly right. Tremendous. And one particular aspect of constitutional law has been on your mind lately. What is that?
Well, that is the free exercise clause of the First Amendment and its relationship to the various statutes that have been passed recently that go by the acronym RFRA.
RFRAs. We just did an entire episode on RFRAs, and so I'll interject at this point and simply say, if you want a primer on RFRAs, go back to our podcast site and look it up. It actually says RFRAs, that's the name of it, and we go through exactly how all that stuff relates to free exercise and a lot of the history of RFRAs. So what I'd like to focus in on now, David, is more your specific concerns about these Religious Freedom Restoration Acts and what your research is telling you and what sort of reforms you think might address your concerns.
Well, I actually think this is a really interesting and complicated area of the law. And I think on your earlier program, you discussed a lot of the difficulties surrounding these laws and the history leading up to them. But basically what you have here is a clash between our commitment to religious liberty, the free exercise of religion that's guaranteed by the First Amendment of the Constitution, and our desire to pass and enforce generally applicable laws that everybody has to follow without giving everybody an out or an exception to following those laws based on self-declared religious beliefs. That's the clash that interests me.
Right. Well, and of course, the classic example, the one I like to cite, is the First Church of Cannabis, which was recently founded in Indiana, where they recently passed a RFRA. And those people have said, we have a sincerely held religious belief in the medicinal and religious qualities of cannabis, or marijuana, if you prefer, and smoking is part of our sacrament. And so that's exactly what's happening now in the country.
Yeah, so what's interesting is, you know, you can take examples that will strike many listeners probably as silly, like the First Church of Cannabis. Mm-hmm. When we get examples like that, it's very easy for us to say, well, they shouldn't get an exemption just because they're coming up with this new religion and saying this religion requires them to smoke illicit drugs or do things that would otherwise violate the law. But then we could take other examples that don't seem as ridiculous, and that might strike many listeners as sympathetic, like, for instance, a prisoner who follows Islamic or Jewish dietary customs, who is unable to follow those customs in prison because the prison won't provide that prisoner food that meets the requirements of his or her religious beliefs. And in that case, I think it gets a little harder. Or someone who needs to have their hair a certain way or covered a certain way, but they are not allowed to wear their hair in the way that their religion suggests it ought to be worn because the government won't let them in that particular circumstance.
Right.
So the examples that we choose will lead us to different paths, and that's what makes the issue so interesting. I think you and I have talked about this question before, and I was suggesting that there actually is some merit to these RFRAs, or these Religious Freedom Restoration Acts. I am not sure I support the exact language in many of these state statutes, but I do think that if the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment is going to mean anything, it has to mean that courts ought to be able to review statutes to make sure that those statutes are not unduly burdening the free exercise of religion by United States citizens. And if we don't actually look hard at statutes to see if they are unduly burdening religious exercise, then we might as well not have a free exercise clause in the Constitution, right? So there's a balance. I think each time a person makes a claim that they should be exempt from a generally applicable law because that law violates their own either religious conscience or doesn't allow them to exercise their religion the way they want to, I think the courts have to balance in some sense the importance of the public policy that the law is advancing, right, against, right, the actual incursion or violation of that individual's free exercise. And that balance isn't always going to come out one way or the other. So to me, I want a court to actually do some kind of searching review of statutes to make sure that they're not unduly burdening free exercise. On the other hand, I don't want to open the door to everybody getting an exception for anything based on some, you know, brand new religion they make up on the spot.
Okay, so is it fair to say then that you think that the current constitutional interpretation in the Smith case of 1990 is a little bit too much rough justice? It gives the government too free a pass by saying if you've got a neutral, generally applicable law, then it doesn't have to, you don't have to grant an accommodation. That's just a little too easy for you then.
That's right. That's right. I think that it's too easy under the doctrine of Employment Division v. Smith for the government to place serious burdens on people's exercise of their religious freedom without having to do any kind of balancing at all. I would like the courts to look hard at each case to ensure that we are not simply ignoring the free exercise claims of those who make them.
Okay, so the first thing would be that a person has to come through and demonstrate a substantial burden. And I think most RFRAs do require that to begin with.
I think that's right.
Okay, and you know, we're not talking about silly things. You know, significant. You have to show me, if I'm the judge, that what you're talking about really is part of your religion. It's really
correct.
Sincerely beheld and held belief. It might be a new belief, but it's sincere.
Right.
Because all religions were new once. But if you show me that and it's going to be a burden, then we have to evaluate whether we're going to get you're getting an accommodation or not.
Right.
That's where the rubber hits the road, and that's where the standard of review, at least in the federal RFRA, causes so much trouble, because the federal RFRA gives us the highest burden the government can face, the so-called strict scrutiny. Do you favor strict scrutiny for these things, or do you some more flexible level of scrutiny?
Well, I hate to sound, you know, like Goldilocks here, but I think, you know, strict scrutiny is a little too tough, right? Rational basis, which is what we end up with in Smith, is the lowest level,
right,
is a little bit too easy.
Uh-huh.
Maybe we need some kind of intermediate scrutiny or something. Right, something in the middle. And, you know, these tiers of scrutiny, of course, are just really placeholders for telling us what attitude the court is going to take towards the statute in question. Are they going to look really hard? Are they going to think about, you know, what are the purposes behind the statute? What social good is achieved or trying to be achieved through this statute? And what's really the burden if we grant an exemption? What is the burden on the social good that the statute was meant to achieve if we allow for some accommodation for people making religious freedom claims? And then balance that against how substantial is the burden on the claimant's actual religious practice. And I don't think we can prejudge in any particular case which way the court ought to come out. And indeed, even people who agree with me at the level of generality I'm speaking at may disagree with me on individual cases.
Particular outcomes.
Right,
yeah.
Particular outcomes of bigger cases. But I am suggesting that where we are now, at least at the constitutional level, without these RFRAs, is much too lenient on the government. And again, I have to ask, what's the point of having a free exercise clause if the government can simply pass a law that, although generally applicable and not intended to stamp out your religious exercise, in fact does?
Understood. In fact, let's take an example of that. I mean, technically speaking, you're not supposed to, I think probably in all 50 states, let children under 21 consume alcohol or at least buy it for them.
Great.
If that were strictly enforced, there would not be a lot of communions going on.
That's a lot of
Catholic churches.
That's a very good example. My understanding is that during the Prohibition era, there was some kind of exception made.
Yes, there was. The Olmsted Act actually had. In fact, that's why priests became huge suppliers of wine, because it was sacramental wine.
Right.
Back under the Depression. So they had an exemption under the Olmsted Act.
Right.
But currently, as far as I know, many states probably don't have such a thing. And so there would be a law that is neutral. It's generally applicable and probably not aimed at Catholics. And yet it could very easily be enforced against them in a way. In fact, if it was very evenly enforced, it could deprive a lot of people, including a lot of Protestants who use wine in their communion services, of that ability to participate in one of the most important sacraments.
Well, I think that's exactly right, and that's problematic on its own. But I want to go another step back to something you said, which is that law is probably not aimed at stamping out Catholicism, and I think that's probably right. But I think if you look at the history of the Prohibition movement, I think you will find a lot of anti-Catholic fervor, and that's for me an important point, because it seems to me that this idea that there's a class of statutes that are neutral and generally applicable and never had anything to do with religious differences is a little bit of a red herring, because in fact lots of statutes get passed with a lot of different motivations, a lot of different intents, and perhaps one of the things motivating legislators to vote in favor of prohibition when they did and when they do is their own religious views about the consumption of alcohol and their distaste, so to speak, for the consumption of alcohol by people of different religious persuasions.
David, are you questioning the purity of our legislative
process? Not at all. I think it's perfectly appropriate. I think it's perfectly appropriate for all kinds of interests to come into play when legislators make their decisions, including their moral views, and that's fine.
But you question the very concept of neutral.
I do, and I think that part of the reason why you want heightened scrutiny of laws that in fact burden religion is to make sure, is to smoke out these kinds of bigoted intentions on the part of legislatures.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with my colleague and friend David Wolitz at the University of Tennessee College of Law, all about religious freedom restoration acts and also their conflicts with other constitutional values and provisions, notably equality in the context of gay marriage. After the break, we'll come back, speak some more with David, and then we'll talk to yet another friend and colleague, Doug McKechnie. So stick around. We'll be right back. You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with my colleague David Wolitz from the University of Tennessee's College of Law about Religious Freedom Restoration Acts. And they've been very much in the news lately, especially when it comes to the conflict on the one side between, for example, a conservative Christian baker or caterer who doesn't want to cater a gay wedding and the gay couple that wants to hire that person. And so we've got a conflict between religious freedom on the one side and equality on the other. And David and I are talking about the proper level of scrutiny that the court should give when the government passes a law that looks neutral, looks like it's generally applicable, but maybe we need to smoke out and see if there are any bad motives there.
For instance, a very recent phenomenon that we're seeing, not just in the United States, but overseas as well, is a desire to ban circumcision. Mm-hmm. Right now, a lot of people in the United States circumcise their male babies, not out of any religious conviction, but it just became the popular thing to do, although it's apparently on decline. But for Jews and for Muslims as well, circumcision is also a religious ritual. Now, let's imagine that we have basically good-hearted people who want to ban circumcision because they think it's painful to the child, and they convince a city or a state legislature to ban the procedure. Well, I am going to question whether that had nothing to do with religious bigotry. I don't think it's possible in that instance for issues of religious discrimination to be totally absent from a debate, even if it's just one of many things that are in the mix.
Right, but I would go a step further. Even if the motives were perfectly pure,
yes,
that would clearly still burden that practice.
Well, that's right.
Okay,
I agree with you.
Okay.
I agree.
Well,
with
I'm
you
agreeing with you when I say
great.
Okay, I mean in that regard. Now, but let's. I know we're all being happy here and agreeing with each other on all these things. But now let me point out some problems.
Sure.
If you adopt this intermediate standard. The way I like to think of intermediate scrutiny is you can't predict the darn thing.
Right.
I mean, it leaves huge amount of discretion with the judge.
Absolutely.
Are you going to end up with a patchwork of decisions, especially with state RFRAs? I mean, that makes it even more complicated. But even if you get even if it was all national RFRA, even if you had the federal judiciary doing this and deciding these issues, you're going to get accommodation here but not there, and accommodation there but not here. Are you comfortable with that?
I think that is always a danger. There's no doubt about that. There's always a danger with balancing tests that it's the person who balances who's going to end up deciding, and different people will balance interests in a different way. So I think there's no doubt that as cases start accumulating under state RFRAs, you will get what appear to be significant inconsistencies in opinions across states and maybe even between judges within the same states. I think over time, probably some uniformity will begin to be observed, and that the way our common law system works is a lot of different opinions over time tend to get massaged in various ways, or maybe you'll have majority and minority districts. So I don't think it presents unique problems for consistent application, but I agree that that is definitely a cost to having heightened scrutiny. If you don't give any scrutiny or only the lowest form of scrutiny to laws that incidentally burden religion, then you're right. You'll get more consistency and you'll get less religious freedom. and I think that American citizens, by and large, would be comfortable, and certainly the vote on federal RFRA suggested it, would be comfortable living with a little more uncertainty, at least in the short term, on how their religious freedoms are going to be upheld by the courts in exchange for a real hearing in front of judges that take their claims seriously and occasionally grant accommodations.
Our entire discussion today grew out of a discussion we had earlier when I expressed some skepticism about RFRAs.
Yes.
Specifically with regard to the conflict between RFRAs on the one side.
Yes.
And equality on the other side, broadly defined. Now, the particular equality issue that's come up is discrimination against gay people.
Right.
And you can literally have a battle of the statutes on the state level when you have a RFRA on the one side.
Yes.
And you have an anti-discrimination law that covers sexual orientation on the other.
Yes.
And that's where you get the Christian Baker versus the gay couple.
Right.
What is your reaction to that? How do you resolve that? How does your approach handle that conflict?
I think that's another really interesting and increasingly salient conflict that's coming up. A couple of things. One is, right, it turns out that there are a lot of states that have adopted RFRAs that don't yet have anti-discrimination statutes that protect sexual orientation.
So there's no real conflict there.
So in those states, bizarrely, there's no conflict. Now, I very much support the inclusion of sexual orientation as a classification that would get anti-discrimination protection. So I want states and the federal government to include sexual orientation as a prohibited basis of discrimination, even by private employers and other public accommodations. So so I do want a world in which people are not fired because of their sexual orientation, or people are not refused service because of their sexual orientation. So the conflict that you've set up is a real one for me, because these are both things that I value very much. That is to say, both religious freedom and anti-discrimination statutes, including anti-discrimination statutes that protect sexual minorities. So I think that's a really stark conflict. For myself, again, I think what you have to do is say, okay, what is the public policy that we're trying to advance with an anti-discrimination statute that, for instance, prohibits a baker from refusing to bake a cake for a same-sex couple? Right. Well, the public policy that we're trying to advance there is equality, right? Equality between heterosexuals and homosexuals, which is a value that I hold dear, right? On the other hand, if the baker says, right, well, it really burdens my religious exercise to bake this cake, I think we want to honor that too, right? We want to say, well, we don't want to force you to do something that really goes against your free exercise. That is the nub of the conflict. I don't think there's any way around it. I know for myself, I would be comfortable resolving that dispute in favor, right, of equality, as you put it, right? So in that circumstance, I think that the values of ensuring equal protection for people of all sexual orientations is needs to trump, right, the religious liberty claim there. But I can't explain to you in a principled, you know, neutral way why it is that one value trumps the other than my own preference.
Well, your general approach would leave that decision to individual judges and individual cases, especially if this were litigated, as it likely would be, on a state level. So, for example, in Indiana,
right?
Indiana's not a good example because they don't have one. But let's right. State A.
Right.
State A has both these statutes.
Right.
State A may resolve it in favor of the gay couple.
Right.
State B may resolve it in favor of the conservative Christian baker. So
right.
Now you've got a patchwork here, and you're basically saying we're going to trust the judges in each place to do this, to resolve these.
Well, that doesn't bother me. We have a patchwork of laws, and that's federalism. We have we have different laws in different states. So as long as a state Supreme Court eventually decides the issue for that state, well, you know, we have lots of things in American law that are different in Tennessee than they are in Maine. So that doesn't bother me. The question is substantively, what do you say to the loser in either state, right? What do you say to the baker who's forced, so to speak, to make the cake in the state where the baker is forced? And what do you say to, let's say, the gay couple who doesn't get a cake
right.
from that particular baker,
right?
Right. What can you say to them? And I'm not sure that we will ever be able to say something satisfactory to either of the losers there. What I want to insist upon is that there are real losers in either case, right? It's not the case that just saying equality means that the baker hasn't lost. The baker's lost there too, right? And it's not true that just saying religious freedom means that the gay couple hasn't lost if they lose. They lose too. This is a real clash of values. There is not some ultimate tie-breaking, you know, a super value we can look to decide the issue for us. We really do have to sort of eat either outcome.
Right. Right. Well, that's an interesting perspective because, of course, even though we're talking about statutes, these are values which are typically called constitutional values. In fact, these are two of our core constitutional values, religious liberty versus equality. And that brings me to my last concern, and that is that why shouldn't we be debating these on a constitutional level and coming up with a uniform rule for the country? Why don't we simply go back and revisit Smith and see if we can resolve that? Would that be your preferred outcome, that the court actually would revisit Smith and come up with some sort of compromise between the Smith approach and what preceded it, the Sherbert approach, which is, I think, more akin to what you're looking at?
Yes, I'd be happy with doing that, right? I am very uncomfortable with Smith.
To remind people, that's the current rule from 1990 that says if the law in question is neutral and generally applicable, then the government need not grant religious accommodations or religious exceptions. That's the Smith rule. You don't like that one. The preceding rule was the Sherbert rule, which was some pretty heightened level of scrutiny, something pretty close to strict scrutiny, which was basically the opposite. So we've gone back and forth between those two poles. What you're basically saying is you want that intermediate solution. Is it fair to say that you'd rather have it on a constitutional level rather than a statutory level?
Yes, because as you suggested, they are both values of constitutional dimension.
Right.
Both religious liberty and equal protection are values of constitutional dimension. And the reason why you have all these RFRAs, both the federal one and the various state ones, is because of Employment Division v. Smith. As you know well, mm-hmm. the reaction to Employment Division v. Smith was the federal RFRA, which was approved by overwhelming majorities of both the House and
Senate. That's pretty striking when you look back at how overwhelming that vote was and how strong the feelings still are in the nation. Maybe there is a time. It's been 25 years. Maybe we need to revisit Smith.
Well, in fact, as you know, when the federal RFRA was struck down as applied to state statutes, then Congress went back again and passed a couple of follow-up laws.
RLUIPA.
Exactly.
Right.
The Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act to try to get as many of the protections of RFRA back into federal law as they possibly could. And then a number of states, and I don't have the statistics on me, but many, many states have passed state-level RFRAs.
So pretty clearly, this is something, if it doesn't command an absolute majority of people in the country now, it has a very large group of people who probably support some kind of RFRA.
That's right. And to be clear, it's not just conservative Christians.
No, it's all sorts of different people. Right. So you seem to be in the majority in this regard. I think you're channeling the majority sentiment is what I mean.
Yes, unusually, I seem to be in the political majority on this. That is to say, the constituency for religious freedom is vast in America.
Indeed it is. So you need to go out and find yourself some plaintiffs. And then you need to take this back to the Supreme Court and fix Smith. And let's come up with your own compromise.
Let's do it.
Thanks, David.
My pleasure.
Constitutional, I'm Stuart Harris. Wasn't that a great interview with David Wolitz of the College of Law at the University of Tennessee? After the break, we're going to have our Madison Minute, and then we're going to have another perspective on this whole RFRA mashup. My buddy Doug McKechnie, who's now at the Air Force Academy, thinks there might be a free speech issue lurking somewhere in there. So stick around.
Today, the governor passed RFRA, the Rights of Religious Freedom Act, and that's been signed into law. Probably nothing that this governor or the last five or six governors have done has been more confusing than this bill.
There are differences between our RFRA and previous states. One of the differences in Indiana's RFRA is that it specifies that corporations have religious freedom too. Well, where did they get that from? The Hobby Lobby decision from the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court decided in Hobby Lobby that corporations basically have some religious protections too under the federal RFRA. Mm-hmm. So this is basically mirroring that. The other technical difference is a bit more interesting. It specifies that you can basically bring a RFRA claim if you believe that your religious freedom has been violated, even if there's no government involved in the lawsuit. It's a minor thing, it's a technical thing, but it's interesting because that specifically allows potentially businesses to use this as a defense against public accommodations laws.
This law does not give anyone a license to discriminate. This law that I signed last week does not give anyone the right to deny services.
The whole controversy about this is that the RFRA bill is going to allow the residents of Indiana to act in a legalized form of discrimination against the LGBT community. So to dumb it down even further, basically how people are going to use this law is, I own a burger shop, come and eat, but not if you're queer, hallelujah.
Well, I actually think what it shows is that when you have a lynch mob underway and you have a number of people doing things that are purely symbolic, that it's very hard to stand up to lynch mobs. The fact is, for example, the governor of Connecticut announced he wouldn't send people to Indiana. Well, Connecticut has exactly the same law. They adopted it 20 years ago. The head of Apple announces that he's deeply disappointed. Apple sells cell phones in Saudi Arabia where being homosexual is a death penalty. The level of selective outrage, the opportunity to pick a fight, the news media couldn't help themselves. I want to pose this question to you. Are you allowed in America today to actually believe in your religious beliefs, or are you only allowed to believe in the religious beliefs that the elite has decided is acceptable?
The Indiana version of this law is not the same as that in other states. It adds all kinds of new stuff. And what it does is encourage us to go down the road to discrimination. This is something that I will not support.
More than 40 years, Indianapolis has built success by being an open, a welcoming, an inclusive city, an international destination, and a hub of economic development. By focusing on talent recruitment, our city thrives because we have welcomed and embraced diversity. And RFRA threatens what thousands of people have spent decades building. And I won't allow that to happen to Indianapolis without a fight.
You're listening to your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. We're talking all about Religious Freedom Restoration Acts, or RFRAs, and just finished a conversation with David Wolitz of the University of Tennessee's College of Law. So now it's time to move further west out to Colorado Springs. We're going to talk to Doug McKechnie, and the fact that maybe it's not just about religious freedom, maybe there's also a free speech.
Well, issue. Doug McKechnie, off in the wild blue yonder yet again.
Oh, Stuart, it's a pleasure to be with you again.
And you have to give us your typical disclaimer, don't you?
I do. I have to tell you that my views are my own, and they do not necessarily reflect the official policies or positions of the United States Air Force, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.
Well, now that we've satisfied the Air Force... By the way, you know, I was just reading a biography of one of the first great generals of the Air Force, very controversial fellow, Curtis LeMay. Mm-hmm. And that whole period of time in the late 1940s when your service actually became a separate service, that's fascinating stuff.
It really is. It's a really fascinating history.
And it has nothing to do with what we're going to talk about. It's actually your area of interest, which is the First Amendment. And you recently emailed me because of all this RFRA stuff going on. And the usual conflict there is between... On the one side, some sort of typically a anti-discrimination statute that protects sexual orientation, and then on the other side, someone who is accused of discriminating against people, gay people, will defend on the basis of raising one of these RFRA statutes. But that's not specifically what you brought up. What you brought up was a different defense in one of these cases, and so why don't you tell us about it?
Sure. The one of the defenses that some service providers are raising with regard to being charged with anti-discrimination or charged under anti-discrimination laws is that when the government is going to punish someone for not participating in or providing services for a same-sex marriage, that the government is compelling speech, and that is a violation of the service provider's First Amendment rights.
Compelled speech. Let's define that for a moment. Compelled speech, as a general rule, is when the government is telling you that you have to say something. And if I'm remembering my constitutional history correctly, the court was very clear on that issue in the Barnett case, wasn't it?
It was. That was the case in which the court said that the government could not force school children to recite the Pledge of Allegiance and salute the flag. And the court was very, very specific and used very vaunted language and said, if there's any fixed star in our constitutional constellation, it's that no official can prescribe orthodoxy and force opinion or force someone to confess a particular opinion.
Yeah, those are stirring words, and they were penned by one of the best writers in the history of the Supreme Court, Justice Robert Jackson. And it's always a highlight of my constitutional law class when I get to read from that opinion. Very, very important case. So the government can't compel us to speak, but how does that apply in a case where a gay couple wants a baker to cater their gay wedding?
Well, what the cake maker would argue, or perhaps a photographer might argue, mm-hmm. or a clothing designer, the cake maker would argue that I'm an artist, and each cake that I make is a unique creation. There's a lot of creative process that goes into making the cake. I meet with my clients, I sketch the cake out, there's a lot of design and creativity, and the end product is inherently expressive. And so if the government comes in and forces me to make a cake for a same-sex marriage, and I don't want to express myself that way, I don't want to participate in that marriage, then the government's really forcing me to engage in a creative endeavor that I don't agree with.
That is a very interesting point. Let's explore that a little bit further. I can see that argument if, for example, the message on the cake were very specifically happy gay wedding. Right, if it was something that was actually written expression that specifically sent a message of approval of gay marriage, I could see the argument, but even in that very straightforward expression of approval for gay marriage, it's really the couple's speech rather than the baker's, isn't it?
Well, that's what the couple would argue, and the argument would be, we come to you as a service provider. We come to you maybe for your skills, perhaps even creative skills, but ultimately, what you are producing, if it's expressive activity at all, what you're producing is really our message. So if any message is sent, it's the client's message, not really the service provider's message. But before that, the couple would maybe argue that it's really not speech at all. Creating the cake is not speech. It's really conduct. And when conduct is being regulated, that's something certainly that's within the purview of the government.
Okay, so a cake maker, even if he's writing as a message, is more like a sign painter than an artist.
I think that's correct. I think what the couple would argue, to the extent that it is expressive activity, we come in and we ask you to bake us a cake. And if you offer that service to a heterosexual couple, mm-hmm. you cannot withhold that service to us simply because we're gay. And so you can't, I think the couple would argue, you can't try to say, well, you know, buy these muffins. I just am not going to participate in your same-sex marriage wedding thing through making a cake. You can have muffins, you can have these cookies. The couple would say, no, if you offer a wedding cake to heterosexual couples, you have to offer a wedding cake to us.
Right, and most wedding cakes would probably not be as straightforward approvals or could be read as straightforward approval of gay marriage anyway. Typically, the most you might have that would be suggestive of that is, you know, two little plastic figurines that are both male or that are both female. On the top of a cake, and even that is not necessarily something that a baker is going to be asked to do. It might just be sort of a generic, you know, happy wedding. sort of message. So yeah, it's an interesting question. It's whose speech is it? And in many cases, there won't be much speech at all, except again for the creative addition, the selection perhaps of colors, or the, you know, the actual patterns of the frosting, or that sort of thing. Okay, I see the arguments now. What's your thought? I mean, is your thought that the bakers or the caterers are going to prevail with their compelled speech argument or not?
Well, I think that what is going to be what it's really going to come down to is the Supreme Court decisions that have really tried to explore what compelled speech is.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been two Supreme Court decisions within the last couple decades, and these decisions have been and a lot of judges that are still on, excuse me, justices that are still on the Supreme Court have signed on unanimously to these decisions. And these compelled speech decisions have essentially said that when you have an organization, perhaps a private organization that's speaking, the government can't require that organization to include a message that it doesn't want to be part of the larger message. So, for example, if an organization is having a march through downtown or a parade through downtown, the downtown metropolis, the government, through anti-discrimination laws, can't force the parade organizers to include a gay organization. But in that same case that the court decided with regard to marches and parades, the court said that's not really the commercial context. In the commercial context, anti-discrimination laws can be used to essentially punish the conduct of discrimination. And so anti-discrimination laws that are focused on ensuring equal treatment with regard to providing services and employment and housing, they've really never offended the First Amendment. In another case...
Wait a second. Let me explore that. So
sure.
in case number one, if I'm the Irish American Society of Metropolis and I'm having my St. Patrick's Day parade and I don't want to include a gay organization, the Supreme Court says that I have a First Amendment right not to be compelled to do so.
Correct.
Okay, if the locality of Metropolis said no, you got to let the gay folks in as well, and I don't want to do it, then letting them in would be compelled speech, and it would violate my First Amendment rights. Okay, that's case number one. Case number two is if I'm the same person, but now I'm talking about, I run a restaurant somewhere, and in that restaurant, perhaps I've got 15 employees and the government tells me I've got to put up one of those signs that tells people what their rights are. The signs that you'll see in a work area. You've got the right to organize, or you've got the right to work only 40 hours a week unless you get paid time and a half for overtime. Those are posters that employers are typically required to put up. And so the employers might feel like they're being compelled to speak in some sense, but those are okay because those are commercial activities.
In commercial activities, and maybe the court would say it's really conduct at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. It's really we're compelling you to do something. Yes, maybe post some poster that the government has formalized and articulated the message that the government wants.
Yeah, that would really be the government speech. That wouldn't be the person's speech. That's just conduct. It's you just have to post the poster.
That's right. And perhaps the court would say, as it has in other compelled speech cases, that there might be an incidental infringement on the business owner's free speech rights, that you have to say this thing that we want you to say by posting this poster. But it's just that. It's incidental. And so to the extent that you're infringing on free speech rights to ultimately achieve a significant government interest, then that's okay to infringe on conduct that might have some connection to expression.
And I think there's several rationales here. Correct me if I'm wrong, but certainly the starting point is that commerce is something that is very, very much a constitutional regulatory power of government. In fact, one might argue that the regulation of commerce was the very reason that we had a constitutional convention to begin with. And so the commerce power is often described as being plenary, total. And Congress and also the states, through their own constitutions, have enormous powers to regulate commerce. But then there's also just a practical purpose. If you interpret government regulation as being compelled speech, well, then there goes the end of government regulation of business.
Correct. I mean, I think that if someone can connect conduct to some expressive activity, and the government's really not trying to regulate the expressive activity, they're just really trying to regulate the conduct.
Right.
If every time you can sort of connect that conduct to some expression or expression of a message, then it's going to be, well, we kind of run into a religious free exercise issue, which is everyone becomes a law unto themselves because they can just say that every conduct that they engage in is somehow expressive.
Well, but before we get back to really, excuse me for interrupting,
sure, Alan, no.
I don't want to leave the compelled speech issue here because
I'm trying to make the analogy between the two. Oh,
okay, well, I appreciate that. Law professors do that sort of thing, but but I'm actually thinking of, again, you know, consumer protection laws. Oftentimes, for example, a drug company will be required to have certain things on its label. Oftentimes, a food company will be required to post on the outside of its food package what the caloric content is or how many carbohydrates are or whatever it might be, or peanut allergies, all these sorts of things. So all these warning stickers, a business might very well say, you're compelling me to say this. The cigarette company might say, you're compelling me to put this warning label on my packaging. But by and large, those are considered regulations of commercial speech. And are not going to fail as some sort of coerced speech.
Well, I think what the cake maker would argue is that may be true, but producing Coca-Cola and requiring me to put a calorie count on my Coca-Cola can is different than, at least the cake maker would argue, different than the service that he provides, like a photographer, like perhaps a tattoo artist or an architect. There's a lot more of the creative skills and creative endeavor involved in that. And because the cake maker, the photographer is sitting down with the clients and really using his talents in a way to ultimately create something that is a form of expression, then any requirement that a message be part of that final outcome is compelled speech.
Zowie. Well, you succeeded, as you always do, Doug, in making what I thought was a fairly straightforward case much more complicated and much more nuanced. So again, what do you think? Can you look in your crystal ball and predict whether you think this compelled speech argument will work or not?
Well, I think that it's going to be difficult because I think there are a couple speech cases that have come up, and inevitably the court, particularly within the anti-discrimination context, anti-discrimination laws, the court has said, we've never had a problem and no one's ever thought that there's been a problem when the government tries to prohibit discrimination and somehow infringes incidentally on speech. And so if the government was going to punish someone for discriminating based on race and required a restaurant to take down a sign that said white patrons only, that certainly is the government infringing speech, but the court has said we've never thought that that would be a violation of the First Amendment, the government somehow compelling speech or refusing speech in that situation.
Okay. Well, that's the big issue I wanted to discuss with you today, because I had not really thought about a compelled speech argument as a defense to a discrimination claim. But you've also written a brief piece recently that has also to do with this situation, slightly different, the resistance of some county clerks at various places around the country to issuing marriage licenses to gay couples. And you came down pretty strongly saying you thought that that was unconstitutional and that correspondingly these clerks had no particular First Amendment right to do so. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So recently in the news, it seems as though states, particularly states that were not interested in recognizing same-sex marriages before the recent case came out, a lot of those states are telling their employees, or at least indicating to their employees, that if they object to issuing a same-sex marriage license based on their religion, that they can somehow opt out or they can refuse to issue that marriage license if a same-sex couple comes to, say, the courthouse seeking a license.
Yeah, and that really struck you, as it did me, as being a remarkable assertion.
It seems to be, because in interpreting the 14th Amendment to require states to issue same-sex marriage licenses where they also issue opposite-sex marriage licenses, the Supreme Court has essentially told states that you have to do something. You mm-hmm. have to give these marriage licenses to these couples that come in. And so if they fail to do that, even one time, even if a same-sex couple comes in and asks a clerk and that clerk refuses that couple, well, that's a violation at that moment of their 14th Amendment right to get a same-sex marriage license. And the clerk trying to say that he or she is relying on his or her free exercise rights, well, the 14th Amendment is a neutral, generally applicable law that's not focused on being hostile towards religion. It applies to all of us, all county clerks and state employees. Mm-hmm. And there's no religious animus behind the 14th Amendment and the compulsion to issue same-sex marriage licenses.
Right. And so the 14th Amendment, the gay rights decision under Obergefell, which was done pursuant to the 14th Amendment, is going to prevail certainly over any state RFRA, simply because as a supremacy clause issue. But it would also prevail even if you posited the disagreement as being between the 14th Amendment on one side and the First Amendment on the other, because the court has told us that when you interpret the free exercise clause of the First Amendment, that neutral, generally applicable laws are okay. And so on the constitutional level, that would resolve the issue. And then if a defendant tried to use a state-level RFRA, then that would also be resolved, just because state law always gets trumped by federal law.
Correct. And I think that the couple seeking the marriage license would have a valid claim that their 14th Amendment constitutional rights have been violated.
Yeah, that's pretty much the same analysis that I've had as I've watched these things unfold. And we've seen some resistance at state levels. You know, certain governors have, you know, sort of proclaimed or proposed statewide statutes or regulatory changes that would allow these sort of refusals. And also there's simply been some individual clerks in individual counties around the country who have made these claims. But my sense is that eventually they're all going to fail.
I agree.
Yeah, and that I think we're simply going to have to watch being played out over the next few weeks. But in the meantime, Doug McKechnie, thanks very much for sharing your thoughts with us about these very timely and very compelling issues.
It's a pleasure to be with you again, Stuart.
And that's our show. Did you follow us on this one? These were some pretty tough issues, and I did my very best to have both David and Doug explain them fully to you. But if you came in late, or if you simply want to hear this over again, I urge you to listen to this podcast when it goes up in about a week on iTunes, on the Montpelier website. And it's one that's worth a second listen, as are all of our episodes. At any rate, thanks very much to Doug McKechnie of the Law Department at the United States Air Force Academy. Thanks, of course, to David Wolitz as well of the College of Law at the University of Tennessee. I think they were both very insightful and pleasant interviews. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our Madison Minute is by the incomparable Jim Blaylock. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Chad Barrett. Our music is by the fifes and drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.